From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, sports commentator John U. Bacon on the mounting troubles for Michigan State's football program.
The first thing you got to do is clean up the program. Forget the wins and losses here.
Parents of children with special needs watch and worry as state lawmakers decide whether or not to hand mental health funding to HMOs.
We feel so disenfranchised by the system that's supposed to be working for us and representing us, you know.
Native tribes think Nestle's request to pump more water from its Osceola Township well could violate a treaty dating back to 1836.
When the United States signs treaties with foreign nations, that takes precedence.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Problems keep piling up for Michigan State University. MSU sports doctor Larry Nassar sitting in jail on federal and state criminal sexual assault charges, accused of assaulting the gymnast who turned to him for care. The women's gymnastic coach who retired after it became known she vigorously supported Nassar even in the face of athletes' complaints. And two separate allegations of sexual assault against Spartan football players since January. Here with us now, Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, here we have the three players charged Tuesday in connection with that party January 16th at a party, an apartment on campus. First degree and third degree criminal sexual conduct charges against Josh King of Illinois and third degree CSG charges against Donnie Corley and Demetric Vance from the Detroit area. And this is in addition to charges filed against Austin Robertson for allegedly raping a woman in her apartment in April. A lot of people are wondering just what is going on in East Lansing.
Whatever it is not good. Now, look, this does not speak for all the players. As we both know, of course, innocent until proven guilty, so we'll honor that, obviously.
Yes.
But
they've been cut from the team.
That's a lot of smoke. It's a whole lot of smoke.
Yeah.
And cut from the team means, look, the football team legally does not have to wait around for a court decision to make their own value judgments. They've made their own based on what they know about it, which tells us something on this one. Now, on the one hand, I can see human behavior at its absolute worst, which is what we see here. Two, I think Mark D'Antonio, the football coach, blew it when he first addressed these things, I think in February, when he says, we'll overcome this and blah, blah, blah. No, no, no. It's not a football question. This is not a quarterback's knee we have to overcome here. This goes far beyond that. So he missed the boat on this one. I think Luana Simon, the president at Michigan State, missed the boat also on the gymnastics trainer, the doctor, Dr. Nassar. She said some very unfortunate comments about all this.
Such as?
Basically blaming the victims and saying that it's impossible to get a pedophile if they're determined. And a gymnast in question wrote a public letter, and go look this one up. It's brilliant. And she nailed it, saying, we brought this to your attention many times and you've ignored it. Mm-hmm. So don't tell me you didn't know about it.
Because we're talking about accusations that go back decades.
Look, for a bully to work, you need the bully, the victim, and some adult watching it doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's the case here. Now, that's the worst behavior. What I consider amongst the best behavior that humans can pull off in a situation is Mark Hollis, the AD at Michigan State. Ultimately, this ends up on his desk. So he clearly has some responsibility, and he's taking that appropriately. However, when almost everybody else would have lawyered up, run it past the PR machine, the president, the regents, and so on, he got out there and spoke, as he said, like a human being. And he actually did, heart to heart. And he said two things that were brilliant. One, this is not – we're not addressing this as a football issue. This is a human being issue. Two, seeing it from the alleged victim's point of view. That term we have to use for now, of course. And I thought he was wonderful with it. He said, look, I think about her as my daughter. How would you feel? What would you do?
And he talked about wanting that Michigan State University community to feel like a safe home.
It's where my wife and I attended school, where one son and my daughter earned their degree, where my other son will enroll this fall. I expect my home to be safe. Safe to all that live here and safe to all that visit. Like any home, its safety requires shared responsibility and accountability. As athletic director, I am responsible to make tomorrow better than today.
So he's trying to restore the culture. I think Mark Hollis, I've always said, he's one of the best ADs in the business, and when faced with a dire situation, he's really come through. Look, and you'll get a better response ultimately doing it this way than you do lawyering up. In Michigan, the hospital has discovered here at the University of Michigan is apologizing to patients actually works.
When we know that the university hired Jones Day Law Firm to come in and do that investigation, and it said that D'Antonio did everything right once he heard the accusations.
That should be pointed out, in fairness to D'Antonio.
Yes, he immediately jumped in. This isn't what we've seen in other,
elsewhere.
For example, Penn State.
Or Baylor,
exactly. But what does it tell us that these cases exist in the first place?
Well, one theory goes, and it's only a theory right now, that D'Antonio, one of the best coaches in the country, in my opinion, got to the Final Four in football a few years ago by recruiting 2- and 3-star players out of 5, players that Michigan wouldn't recruit normally. Turns them into grinders. They stick around for 4 or 5 years, and you win Big Ten titles. And this guy was top 5 for 3 years in a row. Very impressive run. Once that happened, you started getting the 4- and 5-star players you couldn't get before, and the theory is that perhaps the filter on character was not as strong as it was before. Mm-hmm. They were too tempted by their success.
Now, the Board of Trustees held that closed-door meeting, which supposedly, you know, with D'Antonio and Hollis, that was already scheduled to talk about budgets.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And then,
by the way, budget meetings are not closed-door.
Okay.
Just to be clear.
And then stepped out and made that public statement giving a vote of confidence to both men. What does it mean?
From the trustees.
Yeah, from the trustees. If a Board of Trustees goes out of its way, based on what you've seen in the past, to go, yes, we're behind them, what do you take out of that?
That is the second thing you least want to hear, the least being you're fired.
Okay.
So you never want to hear this because that means they're answering a question that no one has yet posed, which is, are their jobs in jeopardy? So they clearly feel that had to be addressed. I think right now that D'Antonio's job is in far greater jeopardy than Hollis's, especially based on Hollis's brilliant response to this. He's 3-9. D'Antonio, the coach, little flat-footed. First, he recruited these guys. He was monitoring these guys. It's more on him than on Hollis. I still think he can save his job. The first thing you got to do is clean up the program. Forget the wins and losses here. Get back to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And if he does that, they'll be a good team next year anyway. Not a great team, but a decent team. So you don't want to hear that. However, the ball is now in their court. If they clean it up, they'll be okay.
Mark D'Antonio said, we had the education, we had the classes. I mean, what does it say to us that they have to sit athletes down and say things like no means no? And
keep in mind, they sit down everybody these days, though.
Yeah, they do.
They sit down frat boys. They sit down, if you're in a dormitory, you have a clinic on this also. Everyone gets this. The whole lesson should be 3 words, right? No means no. And that's it. But it's more complicated than that. But a class is not going to recover for poor character, which might well be the case here. Character is something you bring to the table for 17 or 18 years when you show up on any campus. And if that is deeply flawed or broken, a 4-hour class on sensitivity is not going to fix it.
You followed and dug into other schools in crisis mode. Certainly for your book, you closely followed Penn State in the wake of the Jerry Sandusky disaster, horrific scandal. So
it's simple.
What do you do?
Don Canham, Michigan AD, never turn a one-day story into a 2-day story.
You've said that a lot on this program.
I say it a lot, and no one ever listens. I can keep saying it. As simple as it sounds, it's very hard to do because everyone wants to cover their butts, try to get away with something, not admit the whole thing. What Hollis did is how you handle this. Mm-hmm. You cough it all up. You lay yourself bare and get it behind you as fast as you can while addressing it. Obviously, not just the victims here. We need to address them naturally and give them all the help they need. I'm not saying rush that process by any means, but get down to the truth, all right, fix the problem and move on. You start playing games with this stuff, as Penn State has been doing for 5 years. 5 years now we've been on this one. Actually, 6, incredibly. And now you've got the president of Penn State going to jail for 2 months, which strikes me as about right, frankly. Mm-hmm. That's Graham Spanier. Mm-hmm. I think if I'm Luana Simon, I watch that case very closely.
Seriously?
Absolutely.
Because?
Because if she is found to have done the same thing.
When you say playing games.
Playing games is they have an email from Graham Spanier to his minions, the athletic director, and I think the vice president, saying, you know, we got to cover our butts on this one. We're going to handle it internally. And once you have an email like that, it's a public university, it's FOIA and all that, you're in deep trouble and you might be going to jail. And frankly, you should be at that point because you've put the PR aspect of your university ahead of the safety of 10-year-old kids. Now, if Michigan State has found to have done that with some emails with this Dr. Nasser, who's been there for 20 years, I would be very surprised if there's not an email somewhere. Then you're in big trouble.
You have to wonder what parents might think about whether or not they want their child to go to Michigan
State.
And
that's why what Mark Hollis said is so important. Mark Hollis gets it. If I'm a parent of a 17-year-old boy or girl about to go to Michigan State and I hear him saying that, I think, okay, this is horrible, you know, inexcusable. And this better be fixed and fast to the degree that it can be. But that's the kind of guy who gets it. This is supposed to be a home where you're safe. And that's what I want to hear.
How long do you think it takes to kind of root out whatever's going on
Depends on how deep it is. Depends on how deep it is. Now, the good news is D'Antonio ran a good program for a long time. He knows how to do it. This guy's not been out of control for years. It's not Baylor. It's not the Penn State ongoing situation. I think this is a one-year, two-year horrible aberration that he needs to get back to who he is and how he coaches, and he'll be okay. So in his case, it should not be that hard. Hollis knows how to do this also. This should be fixable, to the degree that it can be fixed.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubanks. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
20 years ago this day, Joe Louis Arena, Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Finals. The Detroit Red Wings led Philadelphia 2-0 with just 15 seconds left in the game when the Flyers made it 2-1.
Desjardins shot. Vernon save. Score! Score! In a 2-1 game.
Hey, there is a breath of life left. Mike Vernon slams the post. But 14.8 seconds, it is definitely possible.
The goal credited to Lindros from Desjardins in 1945. Red Wings trying to get the sweep. 3 seconds left. Into the zone. The Detroit Red Wings and the Stanley Cup.
And with that, Lord Stanley's Cup came back to Detroit after 42 years. It was a celebration for the ages that night as the Wings swept the Flyers in four. A few days later, a million people packed Woodward Avenue and Hart Plaza for a Stanley Cup parade and victory celebration. Things did take a tragic turn just 6 days later after a team golf outing, the last celebration before everyone headed home. A limousine crash left Vladimir Konstantinov and team masseur Sergei Manatsakhanov with severe injuries. That motivated the Wings to do it again next season when they swept Washington to win the Cup again, this time for Vladimir Konstantinov. Still to come, the moose airlift that revived Michigan's moose population.
The shooting was the easy part. It was a helicopter pilot. He had the hard work.
That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Nestle is asking to draw more spring water from its well in Osceola County. And as Michigan decides whether to say yes to that request, there's a group with an especially large stake in that decision, Native American tribes who have treaty rights to those waters. The tribes are represented by the group CORA. It stands for the Chippewa-Ottawa Resource Authority. With us now is Mike Ripley, who's the environmental coordinator for CORA. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's good to be here.
Tell us what tribes CORA represents.
CORA represents five tribes that have treaty rights in the 1836 treaty area of Michigan. So those five tribes are starting from the south, Little River Band of Ottawa Indians in Traverse City, the Grand Traverse Band of Chippewa and Ottawa Indians, the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians and Petoskey, and in the Upper Peninsula, the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians and the Bay Mills Indian Community.
And as you cited this treaty from 1836, we need to talk some history. So take us back and tell us about that treaty and what it entails.
Well, for many years in the 1800s, the United States wanted to sign a treaty to obtain the lands in Michigan so that Michigan could become a state. So in 1836, our ancestors signed a treaty with the United States that ceded a large chunk of land that eventually became Michigan in 1837. But our ancestors never signed away the rights for their children and grandchildren into the future to be able to hunt and fish and make a living in the traditional way that they had always done. So those treaty rights were preserved, and this is at the highest level in the United States, you know, at a constitutional level. When the United States signs treaties with foreign nations, that takes precedence.
And this area that we're talking about, where the Nestle plant is in Osceola Township, I take it is right there where this treaty covers.
Yes, our treaty goes as far south on the Lake Michigan side as the Grand River.
And up north to?
All the way over to Marquette, on in part of Lake Superior, and down to Alpena in Lake Huron.
So tell us, Mike Ripley, what are the tribe's concerns with this request from Nestle? They're pumping 150 gallons a minute, and they want permission to pump 400 gallons a minute.
At 400 gallons per minute, we believe that there will be significant impacts to the headwaters of that watershed, and which is a watershed of the Muskegon River. Right now, there are cold water streams that come out of those springs. There are wetlands in that area. Cold water fisheries include trout and other fish which need cold water. So when Nestle takes 400 gallons per minute, and if that affects the water levels in there and it becomes a warm water stream, then the cold water fisheries are destroyed. And also the wetlands are either destroyed or altered.
And there's no going back once that happens.
That's right.
And what kind of talks have you been able to have with the state?
We have met with the state and all the tribes in Michigan, not just the Cora tribes, but all 12 tribes, have met with the state three times since the first of the year, first of 2017. So that's significant.
Yeah, are you satisfied with the access you've been able to get to state DEQ officials?
We're satisfied with the access we've gotten to DEQ and the information that they've given us. Unfortunately, Nestle has not been forthright in giving the information that is needed by the state and the tribes to make a decision.
What kind of information?
Well, for one thing, real-time pumping data from that well. At one time, we understand in 2015 or 2016, the well was being pumped at a rate of 400 gallons per minute. So they should have information on how that has affected the groundwater levels in the vicinity of that well, and we have not been able to see that information.
Have you had a chance to have conversations with Nestle representatives at all?
No. No, we have not had any contact with Nestle.
Although you've tried?
Well, we haven't tried per se, but we've relied on the state to be the intermediary there.
Is that something that you might approach as a tactic to reach out directly to Nestle?
Well, I don't know what good that would do, really, because they've applied to the state of Michigan for a permit. So they should be giving the information to the state, and the state would give us that information then. You know, we're not the ones making the decision on this application. The state is.
And if the state grants permission and says yes to Nestle and lets it boost its water withdrawals, what would be next from your point of view?
Well, we would need to see how that's going to affect the wetlands. And, you know, we're just hoping that the state is going to make the right decision so that there's not any impacts to the groundwater, to the wetlands, and to the cold water streams of that watershed.
It is interesting that here we are sitting in 2017, Mike, talking about a treaty from 1836. And that it feels, does it feel like here you are still fighting the same kind of battles that your ancestors fought?
Absolutely. And it's not so unusual to have a treaty from that long ago. The United States Constitution was put into place in 1790, and we're still using that in the United States. So mm-hmm. Not that unusual. But yes, we are still fighting those battles, and it took us a long time, over 100 years, to have those treaties even recognized. We had to go through a court process to do that. And now the court decided that indeed we have those treaty rights, and we co-manage the resources with the state of Michigan and the federal government now.
So what are you waiting and watching for? What's next for CORA?
Well, obviously, we're waiting for the state to make a decision, but also before the state can make a decision, we're waiting for Nestle to give the necessary information.
Mike Ripley is the environmental coordinator for the Chippewa Ottawa Resource Authority. Mike, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
The other passengers, they reluctantly gave up their seat, but I refused to do so.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
The moose are coming, the moose are coming. That might not have been actually chanted, but it was the feeling across much of the Upper Peninsula as Michigan completed reestablishing moose population in the UP. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk about Michigan's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Here with us now is Rachel Clark, back from the Michigan History Center. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
And we have retired DNR wildlife veterinarian Steve Schmidt. Welcome, Steve.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So happy to talk about moose. Rachel, before the arrival of Europeans, where did moose live in Michigan?
Moose were pretty much all over Michigan prior to the arrival of Europeans. There was a small section of southwestern Michigan that didn't have the same population numbers, but moose are pretty much all over Michigan at that time.
And what led to the decline of the population in our state?
As people were moving into Michigan and settling, they're overhunting the moose and also they're destroying essentially the moose's habitat. So as they're clearing out the woods to create farms and those landscapes, they're destroying the moose habitat. So the moose are either dying or moving.
So what kind of time frame are we looking at? Over what period of time?
From settlement era, which we sort of look at from anywhere from 1805 to 1835 when we become a state, or write our constitution rather. And then all the way up to 1935 is when there are the first efforts to repopulate the Upper Peninsula with moose.
And Steve, how did that go?
Not so well.
Why?
Well, one of the most important was deer had a biological weapon, basically a parasite called brain worm that doesn't cause a problem in the deer, but when it gets into the moose, it will kill them. As they cleared the forest up north, the deer population was able to increase, and that adversely affected the moose population.
So I want to drill down now on this second moose translocation, because as you say, the first one did not go so well. So now take us up to the second moose relocation. When was that?
That was in the middle 80s. Basically, we moved moose in 1985 and 1987. The idea there was that the habitat was changing, becoming more advantageous to moose. Moose were already there when the Europeans came in, so we knew, you know, we could bring them back if we reintroduced some, and that was the idea behind it. We had a real good group of people over in Ontario, the Ministry of Natural Resources, and they thought it was a good idea too, so we made it happen.
Moving moose from Ontario, whereabouts, where did you get them from?
Algonquin Park.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a big provincial park. It's as well visited as national parks in Canada. That park had an overabundance of moose, and so they were happy to have us capture some and move them to Michigan. And we actually did a little bit of a trade. We gave them some wild turkeys.
Okay. You can have some of our wild turkeys. We'll take some of the of your surplus moose.
Exactly.
I want to talk about the logistics of this. First of all, how big, how heavy is a full-grown moose?
An average size for a cow would be 900 to 1,000 pounds, and the bull's up to 1,200 pounds.
Okay, so this is not just, hey, try to board the little trailer and we'll truck it across.
No.
We're talking about a big, heavy animal. So you were a key part of this second moose relocation. What did it take to get the moose from Ontario to the Upper Peninsula?
Well, it took a lot of effort and a lot of people involved, both with the Michigan DNR and the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources. Started out over in Algonquin Park with a helicopter, basically a capture gun, shooting out of the helicopter, tranquilizing the moose, putting them in a sling, lifting them up, taking back to a processing area where we had crates, where the animals could be put in the crates. And then at the end of the day, truck drivers would head out and drive all night long and to the release site in the UP.
Now, there was some helicopter action here.
Oh, yes, a Hughes 500 chase helicopter, and I was lucky enough to be in that using a potent narcotic called carfentanil. And we would spot a moose, usually in some hardwoods, move them out into a frozen lake where I could get in close with a helicopter.
Okay.
In fact, the shooting was the easy part. It was a helicopter pilot, he had the hard work of getting me enclosed in. It was kind of point blank range. You dart the animal, and then he also had to keep that animal out on the frozen lake, out on the ice, which though I'd had some snow cover, maybe a foot of snow, for 7 to 10 minutes for the drugs to take effect and the animal to go down. And that was harder than it sounds. Those animals wanted to get back into the woods, and so he had to drop down below tree line, very close to the moose, keeping it out on the lake. Until it became immobilized.
And then they were put on slings and transported to where they, as you say, could be crated and trucked to Michigan. Actually, anybody could go to YouTube and watch the video. It is quite stunning to see this moose being in its sling, being carried through the air. How taxing was all of this for the animal, Steve?
There's no doubt there's a lot of stress involved. First, we were hazing them out of the woods. Then we were using a potent narcotic that's about 50,000 times more potent than morphine. Then you're flying them through the air for possibly 15 minutes, putting them in a crate, giving the reversal drug so they'd stand up, and then driving them all night long. So yes, a lot of stress. So we had to monitor these animals all the time. And at least out on the frozen lake, it was temperature. Hmm. We would monitor that temperature. It should be about 101 normally. If it got up to 104.5, then I'd say, okay, we're not going to take it. We'd put an ear tag in the animal, give the reversal drug, and let it go.
Mm. It was a hardy lot that made it to the UP.
Yes.
And how many in total were you able to move during these the relocation, this second relocation?
29 in 1985 and 30 in 1987.
Rachel Clark, what was the local reaction in the UP to getting moose back in there again?
Oh, people were really excited. Every time a crew came back into the Marquette area with the moose, there were crowds of people there to watch them released and go off into the woods. So people were very excited, not only to see moose. I've lived in Michigan my whole life. I've camped in the UP. I have yet to lay eyes on a moose. Hmm. I don't know that I've known anyone other than Dr. Schmidt who's actually seen a moose. So, so people were really excited, not only to see them, but the idea that they're back in the UP.
Something like 10,000 people saw those animals released over the week time that, you know, there would be a release every day. The governor was up there one day, and they would bring busloads of school kids, you know, from the local area.
Indeed. Dr. Schmidt, how is the moose population doing today? I know you have retired as DNR wildlife veterinarian, but that wasn't that long ago. How are they doing?
Well, there's about 350 moose. Now, that's a lot less than what we had hoped to have. We've had some issues with basically the cows becoming pregnant, and also the twinning rate for our moose was less than what it is in many parts of North America. But there's something going on in the moose population in the southern part of the range.
And when we're saying that southern part of the range, what are we talking about?
The border of Canada and the U.S., in some places having a lot more issues than we are. Hmm. Some of them areas have had dramatic declines. Minnesota is one, Maine another. And they're not sure what is going on. Minnesota has a big study, and it looks like it's a number of things. The brain worm that I mentioned earlier, liver fluke is another one. Winter ticks have a factor. The temperatures, these animals are cool, loving animals, so hot summers are not good for them. That also helps increase the parasites like the winter ticks. Nobody knows for sure, but it looks like it's a combination of factors that is adversely affecting moose populations in the southern part of the range. Now, there's examples, Isle Royal.
Hmm.
As you all know, we only have two wolves out there, and the moose population is exploding. So we don't understand exactly what's happening with these moose populations on the southern part of the range.
What's your long-range forecast, do you think, Steve, for moose in the UP?
Well, I've got my fingers crossed. You know, it was one of the most interesting and challenging and then rewarding activities that I got to do as the veterinarian for the Michigan DNR. So I've got my fingers crossed that we're, you know, kind of stabilized and possibly, you know, we'll start to increase again like we did when we first released the animals.
And Rachel Clark, you can keep hoping, right, as you camp, that you will one day clap eyes on a moose.
I am always hopeful.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and retired DNR wildlife veterinarian Dr. Steve Schmidt. We want to thank you for sharing with us the story of Michigan's moose reestablished population dropped right in there to the Upper Peninsula. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
Up next, as Michigan lawmakers consider big changes to mental health care, parents of people who rely on that care watch and worry.
We have a confession. We are hoping that our sons and daughters don't live longer than we do because we can't trust that there's a system that's going to take care of them.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Major changes could be coming tomorrow in the services for people living with mental illness or a developmental disability in our state. Tomorrow, state lawmakers are expected to release their final budget for fiscal year 2017-2018 for the Department of Health and Human Services. That budget will reveal if Republicans have chosen to shift control of mental health funding, which amounts to nearly $2.5 billion in annual Medicaid payments, shift away from public mental health organizations and transfer it to private insurers. For more than a year, there have been many, many discussions about this. The state convened what was called the Section 298 Work Group to come up with recommendations for the legislature. So-called affinity groups were held all across the state to hear ideas and concerns from consumers and their families. Here with us now are two people with a tremendous stake in all of this, parents whose children rely on these mental health services. Robert White is the father of two sons who are on the autism spectrum. He lives in Clarkston. Robert, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And Gail Marsh is mother of an adult daughter who has Down syndrome. She's with us now from Grand Rapids. Hello, Gail.
Hi there.
So glad to have you both with us. Bob, first, tell us about your two boys, your two sons.
Well, you can see the picture. And the reason I think this is important is that Fred, our older son, is 46. So he was diagnosed 43 years ago. So I start out with at least 43 years of experience, my wife and I, in community mental health. And back then, you know, the support system was almost non-existent because we still had institutions. And so there was no playbook as parents and young parents at that. You sort of developed and tried to work with the system, you know, at every phase. And Michael is 32. And so Michael had the benefit of a better support system, both from an education standpoint and then post-26 even. The reason I think the picture is important is because I include that on the cover of every narrative that I submit to Lansing or to Washington or even locally, because I feel it's so critical to take the emphasis off of, in this case, a line item budget or an actuarial study, and put the focus back on the individuals who are going to be affected by any of the changes we might discuss today.
Gail, tell us about your daughter.
Well, Kayla is 27 years old. She was born with Down syndrome. We have been involved with the system since she turned 18, at which point she receives her SSI, and she moved out when she was about 22 years old. She reached a point like typical teenagers and young adults do, where we realized there was no more that we could offer her in terms of her learning. We recognized that she needed to learn from peers, and she had the same emotional needs for independence that any young adult has. So she has moved into a shared housing arrangement and is supported by staff with Medicaid dollars, and during the day, now that she's no longer in the educational system, she receives work skill funding.
And how has it been for her? What have you seen? How have things developed for her since she moved out?
Oh, she's been wildly successful. She has matured past our expectations. She also has an eating disorder, and through close monitoring by staff, she has been successful in losing over 80 pounds.
And Bob, what about Fred and Michael?
Well, Fred's in a group home, and he's been there for 16 years. And Michael, he lives in his own apartment. It's an independent supported living arrangement. So he gets services for 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. And that helps him in terms of his social integration into the community. He doesn't drive, but he does have a job. He has a paying job, and it really that's his self-worth, and it really is really important to him.
Big picture question here. Have you been satisfied with the services that your children have gotten over the years?
You know, basically, yes. I think that where our efforts have been focused on how do we improve the current system, because there's no system that's perfect. And you have to continually, I think, reinvent yourselves because the dynamics of the landscape changes so dramatically, whether it's from the policy side of community mental health, the funding side. I mean, it's just there's so many moving parts to it that on any given day you don't know what front to advocate on.
Gail Marsh, what's your take?
Well, I would tend to agree with Bob. I think overall we're satisfied with the current system. Certainly the system isn't exactly user-friendly. It can be challenging to navigate the system. But I think what makes it work is that it is public. And if there is an issue, I'm able to talk to people. I'm able to have conversations with CEOs of the local CMHs or the regional entities. We're able to have those conversations and develop relationships. There's also accountability. I try to attend every board meeting that I can attend, every public forum that I can attend, so I can stay connected with the system, and that's what helps it work.
As our legislature decides on the future of services for mental health and developmental disabilities and substance use disorders, what concerns you most? I'll start with you, Gail.
Well, I have a lot of concerns. But as I mentioned, I think when we stray away from a public system, we're going to lose that public accountability and the transparency. A private health plan, you know, is not subject to the Open Meetings Act, and they're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. So there is no public transparency and accountability. I don't know that Meridian or Molina or Priority Health would welcome me to sit in on a board meeting. And I don't think that I would be able to have those types of conversations with administrators and managers in the system. I'm also concerned that physical health care tends to focus on quantity versus quality. You know, we're going to approve supports and services that will keep you alive, but maybe not necessarily help you have a happy and meaningful life.
All those things you talked about, Bob, those really the things that give you a good quality of life.
And I don't know how to capture it. In my mind, I've centered it around social determinants, and yeah. But they are just as important, if not sometimes more, than the physical is always important. But don't get me wrong. But the social determinants, the quality of life influencers that are out there are just critical to the day to day happiness and maximizing the productivity and the socialization, the integration of our two sons and those like them.
And what other concerns do you have, Bob?
Well, much like Gail, I think that, again, the current system isn't perfect, but at least you have an opportunity to get in front of those that are making the decisions. When we talk about moving the system away from a public entity or quasi-entity system to managed healthcare organizations, I think of it often as a shift from stakeholders to shareholders. And what gets lost in terms of shifting the emphasis of why an MCO that now has responsibility or an HMO for behavioral health, why they exist? Do they exist for profitability, or do they exist for the benefit of maximizing the services that not only our sons and Gail's daughter and others deserve, but it's their civil rights, human rights, and constitutional rights. It's not an elective. So change is I'm not afraid to change. But we embarked on change, and we want to be part of that change. There's a tagline that's out there that you've heard, I'm sure. If it's about us, not without us. So don't make decisions that affect us in our daily lives without our voice being part of the decision-making process.
Certainly, we've seen as you look across the country, a lot of states have moved toward a system in which mental and physical health services are more integrated. And the health plans, which by most accounts have performed well in handling the physical health services for Medicaid recipients, they're arguing that integration will improve outcomes for people like your children while being more efficient. You're shaking your head.
Well, I get really energized when somebody talks like integration doesn't exist today. We have integrated health today with physical and behavioral. My sons have primary care physicians, and the integration on the behavioral side happens through his supports coordinator, who is a lot closer and knows my two sons intimately because they've been assigned and worked with them for years. So when I hear a legislator or when I hear an executive director representing an HMO or an MCO say, well, don't you agree with treating the body and the mind and the whole person? I get incensed because they almost talk from a standpoint that there's this huge void today. And that's not the case.
Gail, is this integration of mental and physical health care a priority for you?
Well, absolutely, with regard to service delivery. Certainly, we want to see coordinated care, and that is happening. As Bob mentioned, we have coordinated partnerships. There's a lot of new programs. But I think that we've proven that privatization doesn't work. I only need to point to the Veterans Administration disaster, the prison food system disaster.
What have the health plans said to you in terms of what would change?
Well, that's interesting. I think that if I'd heard one of the health plans say, if we transfer the funding of behavioral health over to us from the public entity, here are the benefits that you're going to receive. Why, as a parent, if I read through that list of benefits and improved services, would I ever say, no, I don't want that? But the only two areas that I continue to hear them say is we can save money. There's been a lot of debate about how much they can save. And then certainly there's a lot of questions about how that savings will be reinvested into the services, or will it go to the shareholder or the stock price. And the other thing they say is, well, we're doing it in other states. And look, I've done as much research as I can on this activity in other states, and I beg to differ with them. There is not one feedback that I get from other states that are going down this path of integration of the funding of behavioral health that isn't struggling right now.
Gail, do you share these concerns?
Well, I certainly do, and one of my biggest concerns, I was a member of the Lieutenant Governor's original Section 298 work group. And repeatedly, the primary stakeholders, the consumers and their families, called for a system that ensured the public oversight, the accountability, and the transparency that I've already discussed. Mm-hmm. So, and this was also overwhelmingly supported in over 30 affinity groups of eligible persons and families in Michigan. So I was outraged, if you will, when the legislature this year then proposes pilots that call for the privatization or single contract pilots. I spoke to the House Appropriations Subcommittee a few weeks ago, and in my testimony, I referred to a comment that Senator Shirky
was reported to have made. And he said, we've been dancing around the concept of integration far too long, and the legislature needs to force things to happen. And I told them the reason that we've been dancing around total integration for so long is because it's not what people want. And the job that they've been hired to do or elected to do is not to force unwanted things on their constituents, but to listen to the people who elected them. So both the House and the Senate, who are representatives, supposedly, of the people, have dismissed the recommendations of the work group and the stakeholder affinity groups, which were to maintain a public behavioral health care system.
These are your children that are being talked about here.
Yes.
What do you feel about the message you're getting from legislators?
Well, I think we feel so disenfranchised by the system that's supposed to be working for us and representing us, you know. And they're not bad people that we're talking about, but
no.
I think that, you know, there's just this strong pull from the party line to cost reductions that it just minimizes the whole voice that we're trying to represent here. And I, like Gail, she was part of the work group, but I facilitated several affinity group meetings and was encouraged that, boy, they're doing it right. And, you know, they're going out and asking the recipients and the advocates, what do you want? And then to go through that study for that long period of time and have literally the entire executive summary or the recommendation be ignored, it just tells you how dysfunctional, in my opinion, we are in that process.
Well, I think they've already made up their minds about what they want to do, and it angers me to think that this might have been just a smokescreen to give the appearance that the public had any input and that they were going to listen to us.
Bob, what keeps you up at night?
Oh, I've heard this said many ways, but my wife and I are afraid to die because every year we as parents, we're not going to be around to advocate on their behalf, to make the trips to Lansing, to go to the meetings. We have to come up with something that's more sustainable so that we have the confidence that when we're not here, that our two guys, Gail's daughter and others like them, are going to be taken care of.
Gail, how about you?
I echo Bob's sentiments exactly. In fact, I said that to the group of 135 persons at the Section 298 work group. I told them that myself and other families that I'm aware of, you know, we have a confession. We, like Bob, are hoping that that our sons and daughters don't live longer than we do because we can't trust that there's a system that's going to take care of them.
Gail Marsh is the mother of Kayla, who has Down syndrome. Gail was with us today from Grand Rapids. And Bob White, father of Fred and Mike, his sons who are on the autism spectrum. He is from Clarkston. Thanks so much to both of you for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.